Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody, to Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Sparky Lee, a.k.a. Lauren Strank. I am the founder of Legacy Programs Education Reentry, and we speak out against injustices throughout society. And, of course, we discuss the conversation of who's coming home, what's needed, what's necessary for a successful and permanent reentry. And our guest and primarily the host today is Sean. And if anyone wants to check us out, you can check us out on legacyprograms.net. And we're also on Facebook with each one, our Legacy Each One Teach One, Legacy Programs, and just hit us up. If you got any questions, any comments, you can hit us up on legacyprogramseducation@gmail.com. Leave your comments, leave your questions. We will address what we can. If we can't, we will get the answer for you. Like I say, we don't just deal with the ones coming home. We deal with the family members that are also doing the time with our loved ones, and we're doing pretty good with this. So our mentor program, our Cards for the Incarcerated, you know, come check us out, legacyprograms.net. And with that, go ahead, Sean.
Thank you, Sparky. Again, it's greatly appreciated to be on the show, because if I've learned nothing else throughout the process since I started the show, it's that there are more questions and concerns than there are hatred. And it kind of surprised me, because I've spoken with a number of people about the radio program, and they've actually went and they've listened. And there's a lot of questions. Naturally, people's biggest concern is, you know, I have an ex-convict that's being released in my community. Am I going to be safe? You know, things of that nature. And the more heinous the crime, the more the concern is, and I get that. But I think people are also starting to understand that despite what the media has to say, that we are all people. We've all done stupid things, some of us more so than others, and some of us have done things that are far more egregious than other people. But at the end of the day, we are all people. We're all human beings, and we are all trying to change in some way, shape, or form. At some point in time, we all reach that point where we hit rock bottom, and we try to change things, redeem ourselves, make amends, so on and so forth, and move on. And that's kind of what this program has helped me to do, not just the making amends, but getting across to the listeners that there are people out there such as myself that recognize that we've done some bad, that understand for once just what those things are and how much we've impacted people, and who want to do the right thing, who want to make a difference, not just in our lives, not just in the lives of those that we've harmed, but also in other people. And one of the programs that I went through was a 12-step program. And they have 12-step programs for everything from drinking, drugs, food, sex, cigarettes. If it's an addiction, there's a 12-step program for it. And they all operate off the same principle. And basically the principle, it's summed up in 12 steps, but you can sum it up even shorter than that. Admitting you have a problem, admitting you can't do it on your own, asking for help, getting the help, and then passing that help along to other people. And that's kind of what this does. We sit here and we talk about the trials and tribulations of our lives. And in doing so, it helps give us insight. We hear from the listeners who, you know, like last week, some guys were sharing things that, words of encouragement, things that help, that might help out, and so on and so forth. So it's all part of a process. And as I said last week when I started this, you know, it's not about me. I use my experiences because these are what I know from personal experience. I don't want to sit there and say, well, Bill said, you know, blah, 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 because Bill, his information may not be complete. It may be, he may think he's telling me the right thing, but there may be something that he doesn't know of or that I don't know of that changes everything. So I talk about what I have personally went through. And I do that not to draw attention to myself, but to draw attention to the plight that the average parolee finds him or herself in. And this week, you know, just to kind of follow up on what we've been doing before, just as a little update. So I hadn't received my driver's license. Now I went down, I renewed my driver's license. To do that, I had to get the hold off, taken off of me for child support, which I did. May 9th, I got the whole taken off. I got the license reinstated. May 16th, child support suspended my license again. Come to find out, it was a mistake. So I called child support. They admit to making the mistake, but basically said, it's not our problem. We're not going to pay to fix it. You know, you pay for it. We'll submit the paperwork. If they do it, fine. If not, you got to pay for it. Contacted the driver's license DMV and said, you know, my driver's license, here's what's going on. They said, yeah, we see the paperwork's been being submitted. You're not going to have to pay to get it reinstated, which is a relief off my mind because $15 is $15 more than I can expend right now. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to get my driver's license because when I went to get my driver's license, I also applied for a motorcycle endorsement. And apparently in this state, if you have a driver's license and you go to get the motorcycle endorsement, everything's fine. But when you're getting it reinstated, which is what I was doing, and you apply for the motorcycle endorsement, they hold everything up until you're done with the motorcycle endorsement. So these are just little trials and tribulations. So now yet another week goes by and I can't show my identification or anything else. These are seemingly trivial problems to the average person, but to a parolee, these are serious hurdles because you can't get a job. You can't. There's so many different things you cannot do without that identification, and we take these things for granted. But no hurdle is insurmountable, and that's kind of what I wanted to touch base on today. And in doing so, I want to point out that, you know, we've all heard the statement, it takes a village to raise a child. Well, it also takes a village to make sure that somebody makes that transition into society from being in parole or in prison. Now, a lot of people have the mentality that, you know, send him back to prison, lock him up for the rest of his life, you know, so on and so forth. But that really doesn't do anybody any good whatsoever. For starters, you know, again, and I said this last week, we live in an environment where we don't think anything about sending 20 or 30 people to possible death to go save the life of one person. We do it on a daily basis. You know, there's a boat out there in the ocean and it's capsized in the middle of a storm and Coast Guard goes running out there to try to rescue them. House is on fire and somebody's inside, a cat, a dog, you know, firemen, you know, go running in risking their lives to try to save the animal or the person. Hostage situations are no different. You know, we've seen that over and over again on the news. But yet when it comes to somebody going to prison, we want to sit there and say, you know what, lock them up, throw away the key. I don't want to give them another chance. Why do we have that mentality? I get it. A lot of people that go to prison, especially those that are doing really, really short periods of time, they get out and they go on to commit another crime. And as society, we sit there and we say, see what I mean? It doesn't work. Of course it doesn't work. And I'm here to dispel all of this BS about how it does work. The CDCR, the R that they recently added, changing it to California Department of Corrections, to CDCR for rehabilitation, there's no such thing. You go in there and they have these BS programs that don't amount to a hill of beans, and the reason that these programs don't work can be summed up in one simple thing. When you get done, you have to parole to your county of commitment, your last county of residence. Now, your average person that's in prison, a lot of these guys are gang members, and a lot of these guys don't want to be gang members. They want to drop out. They want to change their lives. They want to do whatever it is that they need to do to get out of it, but they can't because when they go into prison knowing that when they get out, they have to go back home. So you can't drop out in prison because if you drop out in prison, where are you going to end up when you go back home? You're going to be back in the same neighborhood, dealing with the same people, and we all know blood in, blood out. They jump you in, they kill you to get out, you know, or so the story goes. Yes, we hear stories about a guy that got out successfully, but they're few and far between because most guys, they don't want to make the sacrifice that's required. But I said all that to say this. So you're sitting there, you're looking at a system that's broken. And the reason it's broken is because you're taking a troubled individual who could not make it for whatever reason in the environment that he was in, and rather than sending him somewhere where he or she has a chance, you return that person to the same environment. I believe it was Albert Einstein that says that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Why is this any different? Why do we sit there and expect that somebody that's going to get out of prison without having been given any skills, is suddenly magically going to be able to make it where he couldn't make it before. It just doesn't happen that way. That's the first thing that, in my opinion, needs to be changed. Because if as long as you keep going down that same road with the same people, with the same environmental factors, you're going to continue getting the same results. And in these situations, it's usually compounded by the fact that, you know, law enforcement is on the lookout for this person, you know, because they know he's getting out of prison on parole. So they've already got it in their minds that this guy's going to get out and he's going to screw up. And that's kind of the situation I'm facing right now. You know, I've gotten out of prison 19 years. I'm legitimately, genuinely trying to do the right thing. I've started a business. I've got my own place to stay. Like, I've jumped through every single hoop that parole has given me. I have not complained one time. But yet nothing that I do is ever good enough. And I have a parole officer that, for whatever reason, I don't know why, but for whatever reason, he is being insanely, insanely petty on the interpretation. I shouldn't say petty, insanely strict on the interpretation of the rules and regulations as they apply to me. And I mentioned this before. One of those is the half a mile within a school. You can't live within a half a mile of a school. Now, I live, there's two bodies of water and a marsh that separates me and a school. And by bodies of water, I mean the ocean and the harbor. So there's part of an ocean and a harbor, and then there's a marsh, and then there's a school. I am 60 feet inside of this exclusion zone. The closest way to physically get there on foot is a mile. And yet he says, because I'm inside the exclusion zone by 60 feet, I have to move. Now, I spent every penny I had putting this place up. I live in a travel trailer. Can't afford anything else. I'm not mad about it, not bitter about it. It is what it is. It's much nicer than my cell. That's all that I got to say, and that should say enough. So I'm not opposed to the travel trailer. The rent's affordable. You know, I'm not complaining. But what I can't do is move it because I don't have the money to move it. Plus, the travel trailer has a flat. Plus, my landlord does not want travel trailers in this mobile home park that are more than 10 years old, which mine is. He was nice enough to let me stay in the corner spot because literally it is out of sight. His house is right next door on one side, and he has a house in front of me. I've got the ocean behind me, and I've got this huge fence on the other side. So I'm pretty much walled in. There's just one little area that you can come in and out to the travel trailer. So for him, like, out of sight, out of mind, he's not worried about it. My parole officer is not satisfied with it. So the point that I was getting at is most people are like myself when they get out. They want to do the right thing. They genuinely do not want to go back to prison. They get out, they have all these good intentions and everything else. But at the end of the day, it's not society, it's not them that sit there and says, you know what, I think I'm gonna go commit a crime today. That's not the way that it happens. What happens is we somehow find ourselves in a situation where crime becomes, there's no other option but to commit the crime. And I was talking to my attorney, and my attorney actually suggested the possibility of intentionally violating my parole in order to give the judge the jurisdiction to hear the case. That's just not in the cards for me. You know, I do not want to go back to prison. I'm not going to even take the chance that a judge in this county might sit there and say, you know what, we're going to go ahead and violate his parole. I'm not going to go down that road. And that's part of what's wrong with society, the way, or the parole system, the way that it's been set up. And a lot of people sit there and say, well, isn't there an administrative remedy? Yes, there is. Excuse me. So imagine for a second, and this is true, I get out and he comes up to me and he tells me, you cannot touch a computer. You cannot be near a computer. You cannot have access to a computer. You cannot possess a computer. I don't know why. I didn't use a computer to commit the crime I was accused of committing. Okay, whatever. I'm going to follow the terms and conditions. And there's all these other things that were included in there that had nothing whatsoever to do with my committing offense. But whether I did it or not, immaterial. So I filed a grievance. Now, I filed it as an emergency, but they gave themselves almost 3 months to respond to my grievance. So that means that for 3 months, I have to sit here with absolutely nothing. No way of combating this and subject to the whims of a parole officer who is being rigid in his interpretation. I go get a job. my parole officer says, no, I don't want you working as a manager for the trailer park you live in because you have access to a computer in order to do your job for one thing, and that is to do the booking. You know, take a customer's credit cards and pay for their booking. You can't do it because it involves a computer. Okay, what about picking weeds? He comes back and says, no, you can't do that either because now you're going on people's property. Now, keep in mind, we're talking about a parking lot where you park your trailer on the parking lot. So my boss calls him up and says, well, what about the vacant lots? You know, he says, okay, well, fine, I'll let him do the vacant lots, but wait a minute, what about if there's somebody there with a minor or something to that effect? Like, everywhere you turn, there's a hurdle. So for the first 3 weeks, he would not let me work. And I even went to him and said, hey, look, I got a job working as a paralegal. I'm not having contact with anybody. You know, I could do the job for my trailer. And he shot it down because I had to use a computer to do the job. But this is how petty he's gotten. The computer, he gave me authorization to use the computer to do my own case. Can't use the internet, even though it's not a term or condition of my parole. It's something he just threw on there verbally. I can't use the internet, but I can use a computer to do my own law work. But yet I'm not allowed to use that same computer to write out a motion for a client, $35 an hour. So instead, I got to go pick weeds at minimum wage. Now, I haven't complained. I went and I did everything he's asked me to do with a broken knee. So I told the story so that the listeners would understand that in such a situation, it comes to a time to where the average person would sit there and say, well, what do I do? At what point does a person say, I have to choose between surviving, basic survival, and violating the terms and conditions of my parole? Now, a lot of people, I mean, you're sitting there looking at it and say, well, what am I supposed to do? Okay, I go apply for social services. I did. I went down to welfare. I applied for a GR, and I applied for a CalFresh and everything else that they had. GR came back and says, well, we'll give you a loan of $132 a month. We'll give you up to $300 to pay your rent, but if we give you $300, your landlord has to reduce the rent to $300. My landlord was not going to do that. I found a program that was willing to help pay my rent completely, only to step in at the last second and say, no, we're not going to pay it because you live in a travel trailer. That same organization turned around and said, we will pay for your rent to put you in this apartment over here or that one over there or this one over there, or even this one over here. Only to have my parole officer say, you can't go to none of those because they're within a half a mile of the school, even though it was, again, only like maybe 100 feet inside of that limitation. So at some point in time, the average person in my situation sits there and says, you know what, it's not possible for me to sit there and do what needs to be done without violating the terms and conditions of my parole, and they just give up. That's why people will go back to prison. They don't go back to prison because they're getting out into society and saying, you know what, you've got a nice necklace and I want it. That's not why they go back. They go back because they get beaten down by a system that doesn't care about them, by a system that could care less, like legitimately could care less about them. And as a society, we need to stop complaining about the high rates in crime and start saying, why is the crime rate so high and what can we do to fix it? Because it's not going to get fixed by people sitting there complaining. It's only going to be fixed when people say, you know what, it's time for action. And that action has to start with the two things that I've already discussed. The first one is allowing people that are on parole to parole to a different place so they can get a fresh start. What good is a second chance if you're just going to go right back to the same situation you couldn't make it in the first time? If your kid can't swim, you don't sit there and throw them in the deep end. You take them to the shallow and you teach them how to swim. You let him make it out to the deep end on his own when he or she is ready. The second thing we need to do is sit there and change the way this parole system works. These people have entirely too much power. This man can sit here and, if he so chooses, come to my house and arrest me just because. It's called a flash violation. It's for 10 days. They put you in jail for whatever reason. Yeah, there's supposed to be due process and everything else. That anybody who's been in the system knows it doesn't work like that. By the time that it gets, well, look at the situation I'm in right now. You're sitting in a place in which you're paying by the week, even if you're paying by the month, doesn't really matter. But you're making a payment for a residence. If you get arrested, you get incarcerated for 10 days. By the time you get out, you've lost your job. If you had a vehicle, it's probably been towed. If it hasn't been towed, you certainly can't make your payment because you've lost your job. You're going to lose your house. All of this stuff that's on your credit, it's going to go in default. All of these negative consequences happen that you have no say-so about whatsoever. So now when you get out after this 10-day flash, you're in an even worse situation than you were before, because now you have everything you had to deal with the first time around with the added stigma of recent poor credit decisions, and so on and so forth. So these are the things that if we really truly want to make a difference, a crime, which is being committed by people that are getting out of prison, as we call it recidivism, things that we need to address. Now, I've sat there and I've watched the news here recently, and I'm a little bit confused because in one station, the news will sit there and talk about how high the crime rate is and how it's going higher and higher and higher. But at the same time, I've seen that same television station broadcast reports about how the crime statistics, statistically speaking, are lower than they've ever been. You can't have it both ways. Either crime is going higher and higher, and it's higher than it's ever been, or it's lower than it's ever been. So I think we need to address that too. But again, it all comes down to, you know, looking at the factors of why the crimes are being committed in the first place. Most of the crimes that are being committed by repeat offenders. 70% of the people that get out of prison go on to commit another crime. Ironically, the very people that everybody is worried about, the sex offenders, everybody worries that a sex offender is going to get out and commit a new crime. They are among the lowest recidivism rates for anybody getting out of prison, which I think is saying something in and of itself. Is it because these people generally don't want to commit the crime? Is it because they've learned something? There's different trains of thought on that. Personally, I believe that it's a combination of factors. Number one, you don't want to go back to prison. Number two, you generally have learned something. Most people, such as myself, that did the things that we did it. We didn't go out there doing something because we wanted to hurt somebody. We did the things we did because we did not understand that we were having an impact on somebody, especially a negative impact. And that's how it is with a lot of crimes. You know, a guy's going out there and he's boosting stuff from a store. He's boosting it because he's justified it in his mind. I can go out here and I can shoplift this stereo. I can shoplift this TV. I can bounce this check. I can do whatever it is that I'm in here doing because insurance will pay for it. I'm not hurting anybody. I'm hurting the big corporation, the one percenters that own the insurance companies. And that's why they do what they do. You take a guy who goes out there and he bounces a check at a small store under the same mistaken illusion, the same mistaken impression, and he finds out that, no, that store owner had to pay for that out of his pocket, and it makes a big difference. It makes a big impact on the offender's life because now he realizes the impact of his actions. And I think part of the problem is when we go to prison, we don't understand that. We don't get it because the people that we've hurt are not people that we ever see again, you know, and usually because legally you're not allowed to. For instance, when I went to prison at the age of 18, my girlfriend, she was actually my girlfriend 3 months from the age of 16. I was 18 years old. I'm not sitting here saying that it was right because it wasn't, but it wasn't illegal where we were from. It was illegal where we went to, the state of Florida. Be that as it may, I went to prison. I did my time. I wasn't able to see or have any kind of contact with her afterwards. So I don't know what the impact of my actions were on her. We could sit here and we can speculate all that we want, but I'm sitting here surrounded by people that are there for rape, that are there for robbery, murder, and so on and so forth. And I can see the impact that their actions had on people because a lot of it is really, you know, blatantly understood. You know, you rob somebody, you know, you murder somebody. Yeah, everybody knows the impact of your actions on that, that the guy can't recover from that ever. You rob somebody, it's a little bit more difficult to understand the impact because, number one, you don't see the person, and because you don't see the person, you don't understand what they went through. But I'm sitting there as an 18-year-old saying to myself, well, my actions, they were really different from this person, therefore there was no impact. And had I had contact with the person, it would have been different because I would have understood it. And that understanding, when you see what your actions have done to somebody, you can't sit there and do it again. You know, it's how many times as a kid have we done something that we look at our parents and we see the look of hurt on our parents' face, and before they even say anything, we feel guilt, we feel shame, we feel remorse. You know, we genuinely understand, oh, shoot, I messed up, because we see the impact of our actions on our loved one's face. You know, so to me, it goes without saying that once you genuinely understand that, unless you're antisocial, you're not going to do it again. But as I'm going along, if anybody has any questions, you know, I'm just kind of sitting here rambling on. If anybody has any questions, please, you know, don't hesitate to just interrupt me. I can't see you. I don't have a computer in front of me to tell me that you're wanting to chime in. So just feel free to interrupt. It is what it is. So another thing that people have an issue with when they get out is a lot of people don't have a place to go. And parole's solution to this is to put the individual into some sort of transitional home for those that are lucky enough to get into it, in which you're surrounded by a bunch of other people in the same situation as you. In theory, this should be a good thing, because in theory, you're surrounded by other people that are also, like you, trying to make it. In reality, it doesn't always work out that way, because not everybody is as sincere and as dedicated towards making it as you are. So that causes issues. And again, going back to the same neighborhood doesn't make things any better. The other issue is, having spent a lot of time in prison, the last thing you want to sit there and do when you're free is have somebody dictate your program to you. We go through that on a regular basis, even not living in a program. So some of these hurdles are relatively minor, trivial, not even worth talking about. I just mentioned it to give the listener a full understanding of what it is that we're dealing with. But a lot of these hurdles are legitimate. And as a society, we need to sit there and, instead of vilifying the people that are getting out, you know, we need to embrace them with open arms. Now, personally, I really haven't been too reserved about, you know, the fact that I just got out of prison or even what I went to prison for. And I've noticed a really interesting thing, and that is, and it's actually quite unusual, and that is that I've been embraced and welcomed with open arms, despite the fact that I got out of prison for a sex offense, despite the fact that they actually tried to commit me as an SVP. And I believe it has to do with the fact that I have been so open and candid about my history. And I wonder if that might not make a difference. And while I'm on that, I kind of wanted to touch bases on this for a while. So a lot of the listeners are not aware of something called the SVPA, or the Sexually Violent Predator Act. For those of you who don't know, what that means is essentially this. If you go to prison for certain qualifying sexual offenses, any sex crime committed or any attempted sex crime committed through the use of force, violence, duress, menace, etc., you can be committed for the rest of your life upon the completion of your prison sentence. So in my situation, I did 17 on 21 years. When my time was up, I didn't have any incidents while I was in prison. When my time was up, they tried to put me in a mental hospital for the rest of my life. Clearly, I don't have a mental disorder. The doctors would have known that had they actually sat down and had access to all the information that they needed, but they did not have that access. But I'm by no means, you know, the exception to the rule. This happens to a lot of people. It happens to just about everybody. They try to do this. Whether they're successful or not is a different story altogether, but everybody has to go through these proceedings. In my personal humble opinion, the process is about as corrupt as it could possibly get. Now, I had the privilege and the opportunity to speak with quite a few people that are currently in DSH. I did this while I was in the county jail fighting my case. And there are some really really interesting stories in what I've heard. And I should point out that I was very skeptical about what I was being told. And I went and I did the research. They were kind enough to send me their evaluation so that I could get the information, not from them, but from the people trying to put them away, which means that it was presented in the worst possible light. And even with all that, some of these people, the things that they were trying to commit these guys on were just unbelievable. There's one guy, for instance, and I'm not going to say any names out of respect for the people, but one of the guys, like a lot of these guys, I should say, a lot of these guys are legitimately mentally challenged. Like when you think of somebody with Down syndrome, mentally retarded, very low functioning IQs, so on and so forth, that's the kind of people that we're talking about. Now, there's one individual, he completely appropriate, I'm not justifying what he did, but he went out and he asked one of the little boys in his neighborhood if he could see his underwear. Now, this guy has the, if I understood the paperwork correctly, this guy has the functioning intellect of like a 7 or 8 year old. Like he is not a bad guy. He's just, he doesn't, mentally he can't comprehend that what he's doing is wrong or why it's wrong. Like even now after having served time in prison and everything else for doing this, he's in tears and he just wants to go home to his, as he says it, to his, I want to go home to my mommy. This is the kind of person that we're trying to commit in a mental hospital for the rest of his natural life. And I should point out that this mental hospital in many, many, many ways is much, much stricter than a prison. So he's sitting there not understanding what's going on. Not because he doesn't want to understand, but because he genuinely cannot understand. There's another individual that I'm actually trying to help out as soon as I get permission from my parole officer that I would like to help out, who is in a slightly similar situation, but not quite as mentally challenged. He did some things he wasn't supposed to do, and he just recently went to a trial, and his attorney was able to get, I believe it was a hung jury or a mistrial, one of the two. And what makes his situation so unusual is the fact that the way these proceedings work is you get evaluated by a mental health professional, a psychologist. The psychologist is supposed to have like a minimum set of qualifications, which include 5 years of being a psychologist and 5 years of experience in diagnosing mental health disorders. These psychologists that has examined him have all opined that he does not meet the criteria, that he no longer meets the criteria, I should say, because he was formerly committed. But he has worked so hard, despite his mental challenges, that he was able to convince these people that he no longer met the criteria because he got the treatment that he needed. Despite not having one single person who was able to come forward and say, this guy meets the criteria, they are still trying to put this guy away for the rest of his life. Now, that should scare you. It should scare anybody listening to this. And the reason it should scare you isn't because you might find yourself as a sex offender facing these proceedings, because I, quite frankly, I don't think the average listener is going to ever find themselves in that position. The reason it should scare you is because what they do to sex offenders today, they do to everybody else tomorrow. And I got a very dear friend named Robin, and she has her little avatar, the little saying on her avatar, I can't remember how it goes, but it basically said, when it came to take the Jews, I didn't say anything because I wasn't Jewish. When it came to take the homosexuals, I didn't say anything because I wasn't gay. When it came to take me, there was nobody left, so no one could speak up for me. Well, that's kind of the same situation here. So we sit there and we do things to sex offenders because we think, oh, yeah, well, nobody wants to speak up for a sex offender. But what we fail to understand is by allowing society to create a different set of rules for sex offenders, all that has done is create precedents, create and implement those same set of rules to everybody else. And as proof of that, you need look no further than Nevada. In Nevada, it doesn't matter if you're a convicted sex offender or not. If you want to get a job working in a gas station, if it has a slot machine, you have to go register with the government. So we create up all these laws and everything else, and we've applied them to sex offenders. And now we have a situation where district attorney, specifically Riverside County, where district attorneys are sitting there trying to commit people for the rest of their natural lives despite the fact that their own experts are sitting here saying, this guy does not meet the criteria. What kind of society do we live in where we give someone that much power and authority over the lives of people? You can't get this time back. This guy has sat here for years fighting this case. That's time he is never going to get back. And I realize that a lot of people are sitting here saying, you know what, he shouldn't have committed the crime. You're right. He should not have committed the crime. 100% agree with you. And even this individual will sit there and say, you know what, I should not have committed the crime. But having committed the crime, having served his time, having paid his debt to society, should that not be enough? At what point in time do we sit there and we say, okay, dude, you're done. You can go. You know, we have these very firm rules on a lot of different things in regards to that. For instance, if you're at work and you work an 8-hour day, okay, dude, your work's not done, but you're done. You put in your time. You can go home. And we do that like on a lot of different things. But when it comes to serving your debt to society for a crime, we have a completely different standard. And a lot of these guys, they sit there and they suffer for the rest of their lives. And it's not just sex offenders. It's a lot of people, like the average person who goes to prison and comes out with a felony on their record, they come out with the same problem. They come out to be greeted by a society that doesn't want to give them another chance. Now, don't get me wrong. There's a lot of really, really decent people out there that are trying to give that second chance. Unfortunately, those people are usually in the minority. My boss, for instance, is one of those people. Now, this guy could have sat here and said, you know what, I don't want you to come stay here and done all of these other different things, but he didn't. He literally, last night, he literally opened up everything to me and invited me over to the back deck for a barbecue. And, you know, he put out an amazing spread. He had filet mignon, which I've never had before in my life. And if you've never had it, man, you've got to try it. A fruit salad, a regular salad, some kind of cheesy bread. I mean, just strawberry shortcake, just all kind of things. And I'm sitting there at the table, you know, out on the deck, and I'm like, I can't believe what I'm about. Like, I couldn't believe it. It was so surreal. Like, everything was a new experience. I'd never had filet mignon, so that was new. I'd never had, like, a lot of the things that were in the salad. I'm like, what is this, and what is that? And, you know, his wife's explaining to me what everything is, and I'm looking around at the different size spoons and forks and everything else, sitting there thinking, you know, like, how am I supposed to do this? You know, what's the protocol here? Do I just reach across the table and grab what I want? You know, not saying reach over anything, but, you know, do I just grab something and put it on my plate? Or, you know, I'm sitting here watching and looking and trying to figure out how the protocol was and everything else when it was done. Like, you know, when do I make my goodbyes without being rude? Like, you know, because you don't want to leave too early, because then it's like you just came over to eat and you leave. You don't want to stay too late because you don't want to wear out your welcome. But he really opened his heart up. He really opened up everything, and he gave me that chance. And we sat there talking, and him and his wife are both, I don't want to say eager, but definitely willing to listen to what I have to say. And they asked questions about, you know, prison and how it was in there and everything else. And I was honest. I told him what it was. I didn't sugarcoat anything. And as we're having this discussion, I'm realizing this is how it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be a guy, you know, when he does something wrong and he goes and he does his punishment and he gets out, it's supposed to be that guy shares his experiences. He shares his experiences, you know, because he's trying to help other people avoid the same things that he did. But he's also trying to educate people, you know, into how bad things really are, you know. Instead, we have this whole NIMBY attitude, not in my backyard. Nobody wants the homeless to live in their backyard or in their neighborhood. Nobody wants sex offenders to live in their neighborhood. Nobody wants any kind of ex-felon to live in their neighborhood. And we cannot continue to do that, because the more that we do that, the more that we alienate people. And when you start alienating people, by the time that it's said, done, and over with, you've created a situation where the only choice a person has to live is to commit a crime. And I give you an example. The other day, I'm down there at the treatment center that I'm not allowed to name. waiting to be seen by a person who I'm not allowed to name. And while I'm there, I see this homeless guy. And I'm not really paying too much attention to him. There's homeless everywhere you look. It gets to a point to where, you know, you see it, but you don't see it. And as I'm standing there, it dawns on me, this dude has just whipped this thing out, and he's sitting there taking a leak on the side of a building on a main public thoroughway. And when I say a main public thoroughway, I'm talking about the actual highway as it comes through my town and turns into a quote-unquote city street before turning back into a highway. He's sitting out there, 12 o'clock in the afternoon, dingling in his hand, broad daylight, taking a leak on the side of the building, and I'm like, what the – I could not believe what I was seeing. But then I got to thinking about it. Now, I live about, let's say about 8 miles away from this location. I live on, like, outside of town. I'm a BFE. And when I come to town, I have to bicycle for a mile just to get to the bus stop and then take the bus into town. And when I get to town, I got to be really careful because 9 times out of 10, I can't find a place to use the bathroom. And I'm walking in there, you know, presentable. Like this particular day, I was wearing a button-up shirt, a tie, and a pair of dress slacks. And I couldn't find a place to use the bathroom. Because of COVID, everybody has used this as an excuse to shut their bathrooms. So this homeless guy is sitting there, and he's confronted with a dilemma. He has to use the bathroom. But there's nobody that's willing to let him use the bathroom. What is he supposed to do? So he did what... You know, he did what he did. I don't agree with his choice. I think you were going to do that. You should have at least, you know, tried to go somewhere private, but that presents its own set of issues. Either which way, he did what he had to do. And when he got done, he stripped down those boxers in the middle of this public place on the sidewalk and proceeded to start cleaning himself. So when I go into my treatment meeting, I actually pointed this out to the guy that was running the program. And I said, you know, the first thing that went through my mind was how this guy didn't have any respect for his environment. You know, you whip your thing out in the middle of nowhere, and you start taking a leak. But then I got to thinking about it, and I realized if I sit there and I say that, I am just as bad as everybody else. I am doing to him the very thing I don't want done to me. I have judged this guy without for 1 second considering what his circumstances were. And when I started to look at it, that's when I realized, you know what, as inappropriate as it may have been, he had a reason for doing what he did. He didn't have a choice. Like, where is he going to go use the bathroom? Same situation with the parolees. They get out, put into the situation where they literally have no other choice. And because they don't have any other choice, they go in and do something you're not supposed to do, which, of course, gets them into trouble with the law. Now, I have been really, really, really lucky so far.
Hey, Sean?
Yes.
Question for you. You know how you were stating that, you know, your parole doesn't allow you to be in a social environment or be social with people necessarily? You know, he puts a tight grip on you on things. And it kind of dawned on me kind of to wonder that, okay, if that, you know, I'm listening to you hard, man, because I really enjoyed you as a person and then your story that comes with it. I'm very intrigued with what your Easter egg hunt, man, of your experience, of your lifestyle, of what you're going through, because you don't hear of this. You don't see this on the news. But before I get into all that, what I was wanting to know is, because you're barricaded from all the activity of socialization of human beings, of criteria, how do you manage to access a bus?
It's very difficult. The bus is a mile away. But I just like anybody else, you know, I actually lucked out and I got some bus passes from an organization. But when I get on the bus, first thing that I do is I look around and I see where everybody's sitting, and I try to go to a spot that has nobody sitting there. And what protects me is the fact that our bus, like many buses in the United States now, There are security cameras and audio cameras, or security cameras and audio monitors set up throughout the bus. So I try to sit in a place to where I'm under camera, because I don't want to be in a situation where I'm accused of doing something that I did not do, or where somebody thinks that I was doing something. So that's rule number one. Everything that I do, I try to make sure that it's visible.
Wow. No, that's just
does that help?
No, that does, because that paints a picture, because of the fact that your parole officer is being such a person of, you know, worth ethics, that I think sometimes, you know, and that now this is a reason why I always get a receipt no matter where I go. They ask me, would you like a receipt? And I'm looking at them like, are you stupid, dumb, or slow? Because I need that receipt. And, you know, there was a time when someone who didn't want to give me a receipt, and I went freaking haywire. I went berserk, because I was like, that receipt is my burden of proof of where I've been, and nobody can tell me otherwise of, oh, you were over here, or I know, I think I saw, or someone looks like, or whatever the description may have been, wasn't me, because I got a receipt that can verify of where I was once last, you know, and it's just weird how, you know, you're treated in this mannerism. And forgive me to say, it's unorthodox. It's not right. It's not okay. And, you know, I feel for you. I really do. Even though, despite your crime or whatever it is that you may have done or may have not done, or it doesn't matter. The point I'm making is, it's unorthodox. It's not okay. You're not a dog. You're not. I mean, a dog gets better treatment than you're getting. And for you to sit down and have a filet mignon for the first time of your life, and to, you know, have a spread to open up and a conversation with harmless individuals that just want to know more about you, and vice versa. Forgive me to say, but you're living life, in a way where you're capped off. You know, it's like you have your body, but you have no arms and no legs. And it's sad. It's really sad. You know, you make me want to do more for people, because I was one of those mental individuals that didn't get a chance. I got a second chance by a luck whim, but I didn't get the opportunity to explain a story, or to try to convince people, or try to, you know, put into perspective of my situation. But you, as an individual, Sean, you give much. You may not have much movement, but because your voice, you give movement. Do you understand?
Yeah. So when I was in CDC, towards the end of my sentence, I got my hands on a contraband cell phone. And the reason I got my hand on the contraband cell phone was because I wanted to expose what was going on. I had a friend in there who I won't say who his name was, because I don't want to get him into trouble. But we had the discussion, and I looked at what he was doing. Like, these guys, they get phones, and a lot of the guys, they just get the phone to do illicit stuff, download pornography, do their drug deals, smuggle in contraband, whatever. And I kept saying since day one, if you give me a contraband cell phone, I'll show you how to work it. Well, one day he decided to take me up on my offer because he needed help with something. So I helped him out under the condition that I could use the phone to do what I wanted to do, which he let me do. So for the next couple months, we were on quarantine. For the next couple months, I proceeded to create an actual brand. And when I say a brand, you'll see what I mean. If you go to if you use Twitter, I can't access Twitter, so I don't have, and I have not had access to this for over 2 years, for almost 2 years. But if you go to Twitter and you look up the Twitter handle, fuck CDCR, and that's spelled F0Q underscore CDCR. That's F0Q underscore CDCR. You'll see what I'm talking about. And at one point in time, I had over 2,000 followers, and these aren't people, you know, what I call your regular layperson people, these were professionals. These were congressmen, senators, you know, various representatives, defense advocacy organizations, ACLU, Janice Bellucci. There was a couple people from her organization that were following me, RSOL. There were a bunch of these people that were following me, almost 2,000 people. And I built a brand. I built a following. You are 100% right. When you're in a situation in which you're throttled, you look for ways to make a difference, or at least I did. And I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to expose the corruption that was going on in CDC. I wanted people to know how the prison I was in was intentionally spreading COVID-19. I wanted people to know how they had intentionally sent people to San Quentin with COVID-19 and how they were purposely killing people on death row in an attempt to get people off death row without actually using a death penalty, because that was, you know, stopped by Governor Newsom. So that's what I did. At the same time, I started a group on Facebook, and I had a Facebook handle called John Imprisoned Smith, which was a play on words. John Imprisoned Smith was the name of the guy who was in prison, and it explained, you know, John is in prison. John Smith is in prison. But at the same time, it was a play on words because John put Smith in prison. Anyway, I started an underground law clinic, and I was doing that on Facebook. And I would literally go to all the different advocacy organizations that were fighting for us, and I would do my part to try to help them do what they were doing. So we all kind of – it was a symbiotic relationship. We were all helping each other out. We had We Are the Voices, you know, all of these Sisters with Voices, all of these different things that we were doing. And – this is up there somewhere. Like, if somebody actually took the time to look for it, and they did a Facebook Live one day. And when they did the Facebook Live, one of the girls asked me why I was in prison. And I told her, I said, listen, I did not do this, but there's a lot of them that I did do. By the time it was done, both me and them, like, we were all in tears, you know, because I was in tears because I didn't realize just how much our actions had impacted people. I was beginning to understand it. I had understood it for a while, but I hadn't actually seen. I'd read books about it. I'd seen it on TV, but I hadn't seen it with my own eyes. And talking to these women let me see it, let me experience what they were feeling. At the same time, they were also in the same position as I was, because they did not understand the impact of our actions on ourselves, like how we suffered and labored and tormented and everything else. So you're right. You know, being in the position that we're in, being cut off as it were, you know, you look for a way to make a difference. You look for other ways to make a difference. And I'm telling you right now, I cannot think of a more powerful tool when it comes to freedom of speech than the internet. Unfortunately, I don't quite have access to that yet, but I will one day. And when I do, you will see me again. I promise you that. And I will be right back to where I was before, making a difference, a positive difference, a positive impact in the lives of people. In the meantime, I do what I can through means that are deemed appropriate, such as, you know, talking on this blog talk radio, which I can only do because I'm calling in on the phone and somebody else is running it, which, you know, but we do what we can, and I do it for two reasons. I do it, number one, because it feels good. You know, the things that I did because I was seeking to fill a void in my life. You know, I was doing – like, we've all done this. Some of us, we've turned to drugs. Some of us have turned to sex. Some of us have turned to food. You know, how many of us have sat there – yeah, we sit there, we eat because we're depressed. We get high because we're depressed. We lash out at people because we're depressed. And we do these things because we're trying to fill a void in our life. Well, I found a positive way to fill that void, and that positive way is making a difference, helping people, you know, and I genuinely like what I'm doing. At the same time, the other reason I do it is because it helps me make indirect amends for the things I actually did do. And the best thing about doing that is the knowledge that maybe, just maybe, my words are helping somebody else avoid making the same mistakes that I did. you know, I'll never know if that really happened or not, but I'd like to think when I lay down at the end of the night that somebody out there who was sitting there listening and not saying a word for week after week after week said, you know what, I'm not going to go out there and do whatever it was that I was sitting there thinking about doing. And last week we were talking about gun violence and everything else briefly. And I cannot help but wonder how many of these incidents we could have avoided if, as a society, we each did our part and did something positive, something to build somebody up instead of always breaking them down. Dude, I don't even know you, but you chipped in and you offered some insight. You chipped in, you offered words of support. Believe me when I tell you, it impacts me because partially because, like I said, I don't know you. And here you are, you've taken time out of your day, not only to listen to the show, but also to sit there and chime in and say something encouraging. Because it's tough. And judging on what you said, you're either going through a similar process or you went through a similar process than what I am currently going through. So you get it. And at the end of the day, you need that encouragement to keep you going. Because without it, you seriously start questioning what the heck am I doing here? Like, I'm busting my butt. I'm working my fingers to the bone. I walked 25 miles with a broken knee. And for what? My parole officer, not one time has he said, hey, good job. You know, I'm proud of you. You know, good job. You did the right thing. Not one time has he said that. And the only thing he's ever said is, I want more. I want more. Go do this.
Well,
do
you
that.
Know,
I
Sean, in the words I like to share, fuck him. And you keep your head up high, and you keep shedding the light, and you keep striving, and you keep going, because at the end of the day, when it's all said and done, and this, you know, you may not win the battle, but you're going to win the war. And you just keep going, and you keep striving, and you keep buckling down, and you keep going, because that's what Jesus would have done. It doesn't matter where you've been, where you've done, who you've seen, or what kind of words came out of that mouth. It matters now what you're doing to move forward. It matters now that, you know, you're making a difference. You're making an effort. And honestly, I don't think I could ever say this, but I never thought an older brother that I get to reach out to over the phone that I've wanted to speak to for over 20 years, I actually get to see the difference that he makes in people's lives. And I'm very grateful, very humble, because I never thought I'd ever be able to see that day. And so thank you, Sean. Thank you, Lawrence, for making a difference, because it makes me want to do more for other people. And I'm a selfish asshole. I really am. I'm a selfish jerk when it comes to lifting a finger for people, because, you know, I've been through two things in my life that really put a burden. And they go hand in hand. And that's when you get hurt, but you get hurt physically and mentally. I mean, physically and emotionally. So when you break a bone, you don't just break that bone. You break emotions with it, where you can't do things on your own. You need help. And
hey,
that's where I stand.
I don't mean to cut you off. Unfortunately, sure. We are almost out of time. There's less than 60 seconds left. So in closing, I want to say thank you to everybody, and especially to you for speaking up. Keep pursuing the issue with your brother, and we'll see what happens, you know, next week. Hopefully you call back in next week. But we only got 60 seconds left. So let me just say again, thank you to you and to everybody else who chimes into the show, who listens to the show. Please, by all means, tune in again next week. Sparky, once again, thank you for inviting me on the show. And you guys have a good week, and we'll see you next week. Thank you.
Thank
Goodbye.
You.
Always.